This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about Sudan. For more than 20 years now, the country has been torn by Africa's longest-running civil war. It's been estimated that something like 2 million people have died as a result of this fighting. After many years of negotiations, a peace deal was signed in May, yet many problems remain. The deal has yet to be finalized, and at the same time that the parties from the North and the South were talking about peace, there was a growing humanitarian crisis going on in Sudan's western Darfur region, where 1 million people have been made homeless by fighting there. There are many people who feel that here there is a humanitarian crisis on the scale of others that we've seen, perhaps something like what happened 10 years ago in Rwanda, and they're trying to draw the international community's attention to it. Now it seems that more and more people are paying attention, and in fact, just yesterday, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, said he plans to visit Sudan to press the government there to do more to help the people of the Darfur region. This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking about Sudan generally and about Darfur with Jerry Fowler. He's the first staff director of the Committee on Conscience, which guides the genocide prevention efforts of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Previously, he was legislative counsel for the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, where he worked on a broad array of human rights issues, including international justice and also refugee and asylum policy. He was in the region recently. He can talk a little bit about what he has seen and, of course, respond to your questions. We just ask people who call in to try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many callers as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Fowler, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
First, because I think that probably many people who are listening won't have much background on the Sudan conflict, maybe we ought to talk a little bit, or I give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about this war that's been going on now for such a long time between the government and between rebels in the South. And when you read the accounts, the thing that will be really obvious is the way that they talk about the two sides, referring to the fact that the North is predominantly Muslim and identifies as Arab ethnically, and the South is a mixture of Christians and animists, and they are ethnically African. And that would make it seem that this conflict is either ethnic, religious, or both. To what extent is this the Sudan Civil War an ethnic or a religious conflict?
Well, the first thing, and I think you pointed this out, David, in your introduction, that the war that was going on in the South is separate from what's happening in the West, mm-hmm. and as you said, it was kind of a generation long struggle. This iteration of it really, you know, started in the early 80s, so it's been going for about 20 years. And in the struggle between the North and the South, it has those elements. There's a religious element, there's an ethnic element, there's a racial element. But I think what underlies it all is kind of a vision of the country, Sudan, and one scholar, Francis Ding, has called a war of visions. And the people who have historically controlled Sudan from the capital of Khartoum, which is in the north and in the center of the country, have a vision of a very relatively homogenized population that is similar to them, that speaks Arabic, that is Muslim, that is culturally identified with the Arab world. And in fact, they have a very diverse country in some of the diversity you've just mentioned. And the people, particularly in the South, have wanted to retain, you know, their own identity, which is African, which is speaking indigenous languages, which in the case of the Southerners has involves, you know, religious differences. And so it's that war of visions. Are you going to have a homogenous country, or are you going to have one that has diversity and welcomes diversity? And in many ways, you know, that's what people have been fighting about.
Yeah. It also seems to me that people are fighting, as they have in past conflicts like this, they're fighting over resources. There is oil in Sudan. There are other kinds of natural resources. And one of the issues that seemed to be at issue between the North and the South was who is going to control the resources, how are they going to be allocated, and then from there also there were concerns about government, who's going to run the country, how much power goes to each of the two competing camps. So it was not just about ideology, and it was not just about the vision of what is Sudan and who are the people and who are the Sudanese people. It was also about who gets to decide how whatever wealth there is and whatever resources there are divided up.
Yeah, well, I think that's very true. And I wouldn't downplay that. It goes hand in hand, I think, with the vision of the country. One thing I would say about the oil in particular, though, that the war in the South long predated the discovery of oil, and then the oil really complicated the situation. And as you say, they have found fairly substantial oil reserves that much of which is in the South, and so that got fed into a conflict that was already existing. And another way of thinking of Sudan is this issue of resources and think about the center, which is Khartoum, and then you've got the periphery and people around the edges, including the South and now in the West. And for the most part, historically, the people on the periphery have been excluded from resources, the resources of the nation. And so that also feeds into the grievances that the people in the South have felt and have fought about, and the grievances that people in the West have felt and are related to the current crisis there.
Well, that's exactly the next place I wanted to go, because it connects the conflict in the West with the North-South conflict, because, again, as I read it, it seemed that a lot of people in the West were looking at what was going on, particularly as the government and the rebels, the North and South, were working out their differences, and they were seeing that the two parties there, they were making agreements on how resources would be divided, and they were making agreements about cabinet posts and how much government power was going to go to each side, and it seemed that a lot of people in the West felt that they were completely being cut out of the process.
Yes, that is very true. As I say, you had this feeling already of marginalization, of being second-class citizens that existed among groups in the West. And then when they looked at the peace talks that were resolving the North-South conflict, I think they had fears, and fears that were probably legitimate, that one result of peace between the North and the South would be condemning them, the Westerners, to permanent second-class status.
What happened was, apparently, in the West is that we had a kind of a organizing of a rebel kind of opposition to the government, similar to that happened in the South, and then the government, and I guess I'm not clear exactly how directly the government was involved in this, but what we've got is we've got battles between, again, we have this ethnic dimension, although the religious dimension is not there, because I think everybody who's involved in the fighting in Darfur, they're all Muslim.
That's right.
But again, we see this Arab-African dimension as we have fighting between African anti-government kind of rebels and this Arab militia, the Janjaweed, that apparently is backed by the government and also is responsible apparently for a lot of killing. And that's where we get into some people actually using terms like genocide and making perhaps comparisons between what has been happening in Darfur and what might happen if nothing is done, and the 94 genocide in Rwanda.
That's right. That's right. You've basically described the situation. I think one thing that's important to emphasize, that there was a rebellion, an armed rebellion that started in Darfur basically in the early part of 2003. And the government's reaction was to respond militarily, which is understandable, but to enlist these Janjaweed militias and basically, instead of going after the rebels, go after the entire population from which the rebels were drawn and conduct a war against the civilians. And the militias, by all accounts, have been operating hand in glove with the government. And you, as you mentioned, I just came back from seeing refugees in neighboring Chad, people who had fled Sudan, and many of them told me about the Janjaweed attacking their village, and at the same time, or just before the attack, the a government airplane bombing the village. So there's very close coordination between the government and the Janjaweed, and I don't think, other than Khartoum suggesting that's not the case, everyone else who has looked at it has seen this very act of coordination. So the government, I mean, this is government violence. They just happen to be using allies in order to carry out an important, part of it.
Yeah. Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Jerry Fowler. He is staff director of the Committee on Conscience, which guides the genocide prevention efforts of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. We're talking about Sudan. I do also want to mention, perhaps I should have at the beginning, that for people who are regular listeners to the program, this is the day of the month where usually we talk about financial issues with Dave Sino. And Dave is off traveling this month, and he was just not able to be with us. So Dave is fine, and next month I'm sure that we will be doing the same topic on the usual day, but we're just taking the day off for this month and not doing that regular topic. Questions on our discussion here this morning, certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Your organization has not hesitated to use the word genocide to describe what's been happening in Darfur, and I think that others have been more hesitant. I don't think the United Nations, Kofi Annan, has not used that word. The United States government, Colin Powell, has not used that word, and I think that some critics have said the reason that they haven't used that word is because if they do, they're going to have to do something, and they're hesitant, and they also know that if the United Nations was going to get involved, it would be an enormous project. In your mind, if people are using words like genocide and ethnic cleansing to describe what's been going on in Darfur, are those words appropriate?
Well, let me be really clear about what we're saying, the Holocaust Memorial Museum. Mm-hmm. We're saying that we believe that there's a threat of genocide. So that's, there's a little bit of nuance there, because the definition of genocide under international law is a complex one. It turns in part on the intent of the perpetrators, which is somewhat difficult to define or to determine. You can kind of look at the circumstances and guess what the intent is, but that can be difficult. And one of the things that I always emphasize, and that I think that we can't overemphasize, is that the goal in international law, there's a treaty that addresses this, and just morally, the goal is to prevent genocide. And Kofi Annan or Colin Powell or whoever does not have to determine that it is genocide before, there's a compulsion to act. And I think once you get to the point where we are now, where there's been large-scale violence, there are a million displaced people, and let me emphasize, they've been displaced into the desert. It's a very harsh environment, and if they don't get international assistance, they're going to die. And part of what the Khartoum government is doing is impeding that international assistance. And to me, that's really where the threat of genocide is the fact that over the coming months, because of obstacles created by Khartoum, hundreds of thousands of people could die. The U.S. government estimates that maybe 350,000 people will die. That's the threat of genocide. And we don't need to have a lot of lawyers figure out, is it or isn't it? I mean, we're at the point now where the threat is there, and if we're serious about prevention, then now's the time to act to prevent.
Yeah, I guess that is the point that also a number of people have made, in particularly referencing conflicts like Rwanda. They're saying, remember what happened, and remember how afterwards we all said, why didn't somebody intervene earlier? Before, when we knew that there was a problem, before things really got bad, and they're saying, well, now is the time, as far as Darfur is concerned, for there to be international intervention. And if not, then we could be seeing death on that, the kind of scale that you've talked about, where we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. They are in Atlanta, Illinois, not Georgia, on our toll-free line here, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a little bit of a question here. There's a young lady in Central Illinois here that works as a professional that is from Sudan, or Sudan, that, you know, if you talk to her, she's African. Her family's from Khartoum. Her dad's a doctor, you know, fairly affluent. And if you talk to her, she really doesn't acknowledge any of these things are going on. She's highly critical of the United States, which, you know, is good, and the fact that, you know, we all need to listen to some criticism once in a while, but if you criticize her country, she really doesn't like to hear it. Being of Africa, so the question is, you know, this kind of sets up her personality and her views of things, and you answered a lot of the questions I had about this situation, you know, at the start of this program. But in the long term, being African, Well, the affluency of her family, would that save her from any persecution if nothing's done in the long term, or would that family be at risk if the genocide continued?
Well, in terms of her family and how they fit into Khartoum and Sudanese society, you would need to know more. And, you know, one interesting thing that for Americans is difficult, when you say she's African, you know, is she identify herself as African vis-a-vis other Sudanese, or is that your identification of her? Because, you know, we would say, a lot of Americans would look at the entire Sudanese population and say, well, of course they're all Africans. They all have, you know, relatively dark skin. They all, they're all live in Africa. I mean, it's an African country after all.
Yeah.
Whereas there are fine distinctions inside the society, and that's when we talk about Arab identity and African identity, that's something that's very important inside Sudan that sometimes is difficult for us on the outside to appreciate.
That might be the problem here. I would, you know, she's Muslim, and, you know, as far, you know, she would appear to be the same African as, you know, the rest of her brothers and sisters, but like you say, maybe she is there. You know, maybe that could be true.
Right. Another thing to just kind of emphasize to make the picture even more complicated than it already is, is, you know, when we talk about a threat of genocide, the threat is really to the people who are living in Western Sudan. And there are obviously people who, there are some people who have fled Western Sudan and are near Khartoum, in displaced persons camps. They're probably not in great shape, but they're not going to, I would imagine they probably won't be massacred in whole-scale numbers. Mm-hmm. And then there may be people who are in Khartoum, if her dad's working as a doctor, and he originally came from the West, unless he gets politically active, which they're not very, the Sudanese government is not very tolerant of, they're not going to be hunting people down door-to-door, I wouldn't think, inside Khartoum. But if he started speaking out, if he started saying, you know, what's happening in the West is wrong, then he, you know, he would be in danger in the family.
Well, she definitely will not speak out against what's happening in the West. So, you know, she's pretty much in denial over all that everything's fine and you know.
Right. Well, so, you know, it's very difficult. You say it's good that people criticize the U.S. government. You know, oftentimes we have trouble hearing that, especially when we're overseas and we're hearing it from foreigners. So, you know, it's a very natural human response, I think.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think you've underlined the whole thing. I mean, I think the start of your discussion was very interesting, and this is way more complicated than it appears on the surface from, you know, listening to news. I mean, there's a lot more to this, and you're bringing that out today, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call.
One thing I want to say, though, is, you know, there's always this challenge. You want to be cognizant of the complexities because there are complexities, and you don't want to, you know, make things simplistic. But on the other hand, you don't, you know, a lot of people turn off when they say, oh, this is just too complex. And at the end of the day, you know, we are talking about humans, individual humans, a lot of them, who are in danger of losing their lives. And this is one thing when I visited the refugee camps in Chad that just, you know, will always stay with me, is looking into the eyes of people, you know, who are telling me my father was killed, my husband was killed, my mother's disappeared, you know, I don't know if my mother's alive or dead. And so, you know, at its core, this is a very simple issue of life and death and our responsibility to people who are threatened on a large scale.
Parties outside Africa, including the United States, have been working on trying to get the two sides together, that is the North and the South, for some time. And I think that they met in Kenya and spent almost 2 years trying to come to an agreement to end this more than 20 years of fighting. And there is an agreement. As I said in the beginning, it's not been finalized, but there is an agreement. Is it the case, I guess the impression that I get is that some people are a little bit, that is in the world foreign policy community, some people are a little bit hesitant to put too much pressure on the government of Khartoum because they don't want to do anything to jeopardize this peace agreement between the government in Khartoum and the rebels in the South. Is that true?
That was definitely a factor in the latter part of last year and the early part of this year. There was a feeling that the negotiations to resolve the North-South conflict were very close to being finished, to dealing with all of the issues, and so they didn't want to upset that apple cart, and so they were hoping that Darfur would go away, that it wouldn't get worse, and the situation kept getting worse and worse. I think that particular view has changed. Certainly, inside the U.S. government, the U.S. government has started to get much more aggressive on Darfur, and this happened maybe about 2 months ago. Because the situation in Darfur got so bad, other countries have been slower to come along. But now that they've basically got a framework in place to resolve all of the outstanding issues between the North and the South, that excuse is not there. And in fact, the ability to really carry out any final peace agreement between the North and the South is probably hampered if Darfur is not resolved in a way that brings about peace and the ability of people to return to their homes safely. So that has changed a little bit in about the last 2 months.
Let's talk with someone else listening in Urbana, where we are, line number one.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
What is the role of the Libyans? They are the third party. They border the Darfur region. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, the Libyans, they have a long history of meddling in their neighbors' affairs, and they fought a war with Chad, actually, a number of years ago. But I don't think that they've had a very active role. There's certainly no indication that they're putting pressure on Khartoum to stop what they're doing, so that they're not playing a constructive role, but my impression is that they're being fairly neutral. They did contribute, kind of in the bigger scheme of things, a little bit inadvertently to creating the conditions for this crisis, because a lot of Darfurians had gone to Libya as guest workers or immigrant workers, and a lot of those people were kicked out of Libya over the past few years, and so that increased some of the economic hardship inside Darfur, where people had been working in Libya and sending back money, now came back without jobs. And that was something that contributed, I think, to the conditions that have created the conflict.
Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think you mentioned a little bit earlier that you had been in the region, not in Sudan, but in Chad.
That's right.
Which does indeed have this long border along the western edge of Sudan, and it borders onto this Darfur region. And you had gone there just to try to assess conditions for those people who were refugees from Darfur who had crossed over the border into Chad. And also, I think because it would have been impossible, but extremely difficult. The government of Sudan in Khartoum was making it very difficult for people, just not only people who were interested in doing relief work, but anybody who was just interested in going there to get in. To what extent and in what way has the government made it difficult for international organizations, non-governmental organizations, who would be interested in trying to do some humanitarian work in Darfur? How has the government in Khartoum made it what exactly are they doing to make it difficult for people to go and do that?
Mm-hmm. That's a very important question. Let me preface my answer by saying that somewhere around 1 million people, maybe somewhat more, maybe somewhat less, have been driven from their homes. I think you said that at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And 150,000 of them or so have crossed into Chad and become refugees in Chad. So the remainder of that million are displaced inside Sudan, and you know they're the ones, as you say, who really need help. And for a long time, the Khartoum government wouldn't even give visas to a lot of the humanitarian workers who were applying for visas to come to the country. And then even once if they gave visas, they could go to Khartoum, but then they needed to get a separate permit in order to travel to Darfur. And they either wouldn't get that, or there were some cases for U.S. government development officials where they would give them a travel permit that was good for 3 days, but was good for a number of days. But then by the time they gave it to them, most of those days had already expired. So they would post-date it. So they were creating those kinds of barriers. Khartoum promised about 3 weeks ago, I think, that they would start issuing visas within 48 hours of applications for humanitarian workers, and that they would lift this requirement for separate travel permits. The reports are that they have given more visas, but there are still some people who are waiting for visas. Then quite apart from the problem of visas are other restrictions that they've imposed. So, for example, for humanitarian workers to work, they've got to have cars to travel around. I mean, this is a vast territory. It's Darfur is the size of France. So, you need vehicles to get around. Well, the vehicles can't get through customs. Or if they let a vehicle through customs, they won't let the radio through that goes with them. And just for security purposes, people who are traveling around in this area, they need radios. There need to be radio nets. And so they don't let the radios through. They've held up food at the Port Sudan, which is on the other side of the country, but there's apparently food at Port Sudan that has been sent for distribution in Darfur, and the Khartoum government won't let it off the docks. So one thing that the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development pointed out is that, to lift one restriction, the passports, for example, the visas, and then impose new ones or not get rid of the rest of them doesn't move the ball forward. It doesn't improve things.
We have other callers. Let's go next to Chicago in line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Much of the information I get regarding Sudan comes from information put out by a man who conducts a program here on WLS in Chicago on Saturday night, Sunday morning, from midnight to 4 o'clock, Nate Clay. It's a discussion call-in program. And he describes the situation in Sudan pretty much the way you do, but in addition, he says, and this is the point of my call, he says that the Arabs in the north are conducting a slave trade where they sell off mainly young women from the south, particularly in Saudi Arabia and points in and around there, and that much of the political support for the Khartoum government is coming from the Saudi government and their supporters. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the slavery has been a problem in Sudan, both historically and very recently. Toleration of slavery, there has definitely been toleration of slavery by the Khartoum government with regard to especially girls and women, some young boys too, who were abducted from the south and taken north. There's been a lot of controversy about how widespread that is, how many numbers, et cetera. But I think there was a fairly broad consensus that there definitely were abductions that were happening, and then the people were being taken away and held in conditions that amount to slavery. A lot of this was done by militias that were allied to the Khartoum government. As they're doing in the West, in the war in the South, the government didn't do everything themselves. They also armed allies, ethnic allies, and part of the compensation for these ethnic allies, they could conduct raids into the South and keep whatever they took away with them. So they would take away property, they would take away animals, and they would take away people, and the people would be held in bondage. As for the trafficking with Saudi Arabia, you know, there's a huge problem in general in the world with human trafficking, and, you know, I don't know the details, but it wouldn't surprise me if there weren't some of the people who had been abducted in the South ending up in a place like Saudi Arabia.
Okay, thank you.
All right. To Bloomington, Indiana for the next caller here, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Several other ways that the Sudanese army stops relief. They bomb hospitals. They raid villages and shoot people at random. They not only enslave people, they torture people. I have a picture of a young Sudanese woman here who was tied up. They Sudanese army men heated up large knives, and then applied those knives to her. She has terrible scars, just terrible scars, and they're still infected. It's 10 years later. Reverend Billy Graham's son, Franklin Graham, runs a Christian charity called Samaritan's Purse, and part of that charity is to the Sudanese people. And he testifies of the horrendous slaughter, torture. It's just terrible. And I don't know. We hear of a young Sudanese Muslim denying that that stuff goes on. It not only goes on, we have pictures of it.
Well, Mr. Fowler, you want to comment any further?
Well, he was saying that one of the things I was thinking, talking about girls, sexual violence has been a part of this campaign in the West. And there have been some horrendous stories of rape and gang rape. One of the stories in particular that I heard that just was chilling was from a woman who had just crossed over from Sudan 2 days before I talked to her, and she had two bullet wounds in her leg, and the way that she got those bullet wounds, she was traveling with a group of refugees, and they had to walk for, I think, a couple of weeks to get from their village to the border. And along the way, she and a 17-year-old girl went to a well to get water for themselves and the other refugees. And there was a Sudanese soldier who was guarding the well. And the soldier grabbed the 17-year-old girl. And so this woman, this older woman, tried to pull the girl away. And that's when the Sudanese soldier shot the woman and took the girl away to an army encampment that was nearby. Sometime later, the girl's father found her in a ravine, covered in blood, with both of her legs broken. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that's happening.
Well, does that, Mr. Bloomington, does that get at your
Yes, it does.
Call?
Thank you for this program.
Sure. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It seems that one of the reasons that the Bush administration actually decided to get involved in trying to settle the Sudan conflict was an interesting combination of political pressure that it faced from groups that would not ordinarily have been allied with one another. On the one hand, people who were particularly concerned with the issue of human rights, and on the other hand, conservative Christians who saw this as an example of persecution of Christians. They fasten on to the religious dimension, the fact that the Muslims, the Northerners are primarily Muslims and the Southerners are Christians and animists. And for that reason, the Bush administration decided to get involved in, and I think at least at one time, was pointing at the agreement that has been reached, even though it's not complete, the agreement has been reached as one of its foreign policy successes in the region.
That's true on all accounts. Religious conservatives were very important, and the fact that they allied with people that you wouldn't normally expect them to, you know, for including African American community and the human rights community, that really helped to get the Bush administration in its early days focused on Sudan and involved in resolving the North-South agreement. And I think that one is an undoubted foreign policy success that this the North-South conflict has stopped. First, there's been a ceasefire that's been in effect for about 18 months that has been very important. There's been humanitarian access to the South that there wasn't before, so that's very important. And then the agreements that they've arrived at are very important. And it would be a spectacular foreign policy success if it weren't for the fact that now Darfur is in such serious trouble and there's such a grave threat of genocide. And I think that as the administration realized that in, say, February and March, that this important foreign policy success was essentially going to be snatched away from them by what Khartoum is doing in the West, really got their attention more focused on Darfur, and they have gotten much more engaged on that within the last couple of months.
We have other callers. Let's continue, and we'll talk next with someone in Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. I would hope that observers regard the son of Billy Graham as an inappropriate diplomat to the region, actually, since the things that he's been quoted on and apparently believes about Islam as a faith would just, you know, throw gasoline on the fire in any region where there's a conflict ongoing. And he pointed out the animus are also being attacked too, so it isn't really simply Islam versus Christian. But that's really not what I wanted to call about. I wanted to ask about just sort of the antecedents to this whole conflict. The isolation of Sudan has been a fairly important part of this. I don't want to say there isn't. Obviously, it'd be ridiculous to say there isn't blame in the capital and in the region. But do you feel like it's productive to say anything about the origins and of this and the diplomacy and the isolation of Sudan? One could also point out that the pharmaceutical plant that was bombed was a huge asset for the entire Southern Cone, it seems to me. I mean, I'm presuming that it's not the case that it was chemical, but it was. If it was, it was dual use, and it was producing a huge amount of material for a very impoverished region, and just seems emblematic in some way. What do you think?
Well, I think that I'm sure most people know what you're talking about, but just to make sure, in 1998, after the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were blown up by al-Qaeda, the United States launched a missile attack on what they thought were al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan, and then a missile attack on a pharmacy in Khartoum called the Al-Shifa Pharmacy. And then afterwards, they claimed that pharmacy was being used to produce chemical weapons. And then afterwards, there was a lot of doubt about how good the evidence was and whether it was the case that it was being used for that at all. And as you say, the possibility that it was dual use or whatever. And one effect of that, quite apart from whether, you know, it was the right thing to do, internationally, it created a lot of sympathy for Khartoum. Right at the same time that Khartoum was prosecuting this very devastating war in the south. And when you talk about the isolation of Sudan, I assume you're talking about political isolation, it kind of had the effect of relieving the political isolation of Sudan, and that actually made it difficult ultimately to end the war in the south. And one thing that that the present administration had to do once it really got involved in resolving the war in the south is to really get other countries, both in the region and allies in Europe, on board to put some pressure on Khartoum to negotiate and to continue negotiating and resolve the issues. And I think that that is also a challenge right now with regard to Darfur, is the ability of the United States to get other countries to join in putting pressure on Khartoum, whether through the United Nations and the Security Council or bilaterally. And so far, that is not happening, at least, you know, on the scale that I think it needs to happen. I don't think Khartoum's feeling a lot of pressure, you know, from its neighbors or from European countries.
So it's quite complicated. What kind of example did the Europeans actually lighten up in that time? And was the isolation, you think, actually going to be effective, or were there other strategies to do something?
You're talking about in the late 90s?
Yep.
The Europeans some European companies were involved in the development of these oil resources, and they had a much more cordial relationship with Khartoum than the United States did. And the United States has always had very strict sanctions, and it continues to have sanctions, and not normal relations at all with Sudan, but most other countries do have normal relations. And that has a serious effect. The, you know, when you've got a government like the Sudanese government, which is a narrowly based dictatorship that is prosecuting a war against portions of its own population, to get them to stop doing that requires a lot of international pressure. And so it can't just be from the United States. It has to be from a lot of countries. And to the extent that other countries are not putting pressure on Khartoum, they feel free to continue doing what they're doing.
If I might, I'd just like to ask if there was any, what was the status? I understand that the owner of the pharmaceutical plant hired a crony of Clinton to take the case. Is that still being adjudicated? Or
I don't know.
Is there a pharmaceutical plant serving the needs of the people in the region, or is Big Pharma exporting them?
I have to admit that I don't know.
Okay, I'm getting little tendentious.
If that factory's been rebuilt, or if there are others, or
I think that I did read a story, and I think this was on I think it was on the BBC website about the fact that the man who owned that plant was planning on rebuilding it.
But it's possible. Yeah. I don't know if he ever got any compensation from the United States government, or if he had insurance or whatever, but you would think that you know, if it was a viable concern before, it would be a viable concern now.
Yeah. We have as our guest in this part of Focus, Jerry Fowler. He's staff director of the Committee on Conscience, which guides the genocide prevention efforts of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. We're talking about Sudan. We have less than 10 minutes. We have another caller here waiting, and we will go to them in Champaign, line one. Hello. The caller there, line one in Champaign.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear the one part.
Yeah. Please go ahead.
Yes. I have maybe a kind of an unreasonable question, I guess. It regards international law. Last year, I was at a community forum. One of the community members, I think, summed it up pretty well. We were talking about the role of the United Nations in kind of solving some of these issues. And I'm certainly no unilateralist, but, you know, he said, well, you know, the latest atrocity to come out of the Congo is that people are cannibalizing others as a kind of political statement. He said, I think I'd have a lot more faith in international law if we could, you know, not, like, eat people. And the things seem to have gotten so out of hand, and now what's going on in Somalia, I mean, just, you know, raises all those same red flags. What you know? So here's the unreasonable question part. What do you think it would take to bring the international community in to prevent these kinds of things? I mean, does it would it require a redrafting of the UN Charter? I mean, is it that basic? It just seems that so much of the policy is geared around go in kind of after the fact to clean things up after, the meltdown has kind of happened. That's my question. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right.
Well, that's not an unreasonable question, but it's an incredibly difficult question. And it's, you know, the question that a lot of people wrestle with. I think maybe if I can just reduce its scope a little bit and talk about the United States government, because I think what happens inside the United States government is probably replicated in other capitals all over the world. And it's a very, it's very crisis-focused. It's a culture of crisis, not a culture of prevention. And the things that get attention are things that are crises. And so that creates a circle where we always seem to be responding to crises, after they've really become very difficult. And how you change that culture, I think we don't have the secret to, but I think it is the secret to a better and more peaceful world. It's finding ways to address conflict in societies before it gets to the stage where there's a complete meltdown of the state or there's a genocide, as in the case of Rwanda. That obviously takes a lot of resources, and resources in the grand scheme of things are limited. But I think that it would be, in the long term, cost-effective if we invested more in trying to prevent the development of mass violence, to prevent the meltdown of societies, or prevent the inflaming of ethnic tensions, than always trying to respond after the house is already on fire.
Hmm.
I think that, that's a long-term struggle. I think we do a lot better. The world does a lot better in that today, believe it or not, than it did 60 years ago before the Holocaust. There's a lot more of a willingness to talk about what one panel called a responsibility to protect, that governments do have a responsibility to protect their citizens from violence, and that if governments don't fulfill that responsibility, then the international community or the rest of the world has a responsibility to protect citizens in other countries. We're a long way from implementing that completely, but history takes time, and I think we're making progress. Is not as fast as any of us would like, but if we keep pushing, if we keep insisting, and that includes us as citizens of the United States, we can keep moving in the right direction.
Yeah. In the meantime, if we're just talking about something like Sudan, though, it's the scale of the operation is kind of daunting. I was reading some comments recently by the Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, was talking about how he would like to see the United Nations get involved in trying to help the two sides, the North and the South, to implement their peace agreement and also do something about heading off more death and destruction in Darfur. And he was talking about the fact that the United Nations had been involved in Sierra Leone, which was the biggest UN peacekeeping force in the world at the time. Sudan, he points out, is 35 times larger than Sierra Leone. It took 17,000 troops to pacify Sierra Leone. And if you do the math, that would suggest that if Sudan is 35 times bigger, you need 35 times more troops, would put you at something like 600,000. And that just seems it seems unimaginable that such a thing could happen, and maybe that kind of simple mathematical calculation is actually not correct.
Yeah, it's not quite a straight line because
yeah.
You don't have to have troops in every part of Sudan, and the part in the north-south is pretty consensual, so that makes it a lot easier. It's not really pacifying, although there's still some problems with some militias there. Now Darfur, though, if you were talking about a military force, it would, doing it in a non-consensual way, there would be a pretty substantial effort, and, where is it going to come from? I think that's a huge problem. But I think they've got a lot of steps that can be taken, starting with Kofi Annan, who I think his response to this has really been poor. I don't think he's used his moral stature to put pressure on Khartoum to stop the violence. But there are a lot of steps that can be taken before we talk about military intervention that would put the screws to Khartoum and you know, give them something to think about.
Well, there we'll have to stop. Okay. I want to thank you, Mr. Fowler, very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome, David. I appreciate it.